And I'm going to go through some public hearings for the purposes of not taking testimony, but preserving the bills for future action. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2002, close a public hearing on House Bill 2002, open a public hearing on House Bill 2328, and close the public hearing on House Bill 2328, open a public hearing on House Bill 2329, I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2329, open a public hearing on House Bill 2400, I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2400. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2402 and close a public hearing on House Bill 2402. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2406, close a public hearing on House Bill 2406. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2408, going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2408. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2635, going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2635. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2795, going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2795. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2928, going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2928. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2978, and close a public hearing on House Bill 2978. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2979, and close a public hearing on House Bill 2979. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2980. Going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2980. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2981. Going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2981. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2982. Going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2982. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3314. Going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3314. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3320. Going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3320. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3595. Going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3595. And we will open public hearings on House Bill 2003, 2008, and 2020. And going to call Duncan Weiss. Thank you for your patience.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise. I'm president of the Oregon Business Council. I want to thank you very much for inviting me and my colleagues here to testify today. Mr. Chair, you heard from Ron Parker, the chair of our finance committee, a couple weeks ago, and one of the things he highlighted was the importance of getting focused on the extent of the liability associated with the FERS system today and what the various options would bring in terms of reducing the liability as you do your work here. And in that spirit, we contracted the firm Echo Northwest to take a look at the various proposals, to take a look at the existing system, and to really map out what the financial implications of the various proposals that we've been watching will do in terms of the state's fiscal condition, not just in the next biennium, but looking forward actually in the number of decades ahead. As you obviously know better than anyone, this is the biggest financial issue facing Oregon possibly imaginable. In the Oregon business plan, we highlighted this is the number one priority, and I've just put the summary on public finance in front of you from the business plan, and number one was fixing PERS. As part of that, we felt it was important to develop a full accounting of the liability and then to look at the various alternatives, including adjustments to the existing plan and to look at the full termination option. And so what we asked these folks to do is to take a look at a variety of options, put them all against each other, and provide that information for you and for all of us to look at. And so what I'd like to do, if you would today, is to introduce them, ask them to present their analysis and take questions, and again, we'll make them available as you do further work on this, as you look at the various options that are before you in this critical period. So with that, let me introduce John Tafonia. John has helped us on the Oregon Business Plan finance recommendations. John is an analyst. He worked for CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, excellent budget analyst. And then Carl Batten works at Echo as financial modeling. He's done very sophisticated work on PERS for PERS, and you're probably familiar with his work, many of you already. And again, ask the two of them to do an analysis of the options and to look at the financial implications for the budget. So, okay.
Thank you. As Duncan mentioned, I'm John Tafonia with Echo Northwest. Echo Northwest is a for-profit consulting firm. We've been established in Oregon since 1974. As Duncan also mentioned, we have done work on a variety of budget and financial modeling projects since then. In particular, over the course of the last 2 to 3 years, we have contracted, or PERS has contracted with us, to develop models, both to assist them in forecasting liabilities under the current PERS system and employer rates. And it is through that expertise that we are going to present the findings today. The Oregon Business Council asked us three research questions, and this is our presentation today is basically going to follow the structure in terms of answering these questions. First of all, to what level are employer rates expected to rise to fund the current system? These are generally rates I think most of you have seen at this point, so we won't spend a lot of time on that, but we'll review that as well as the sources of the problems that brought us those rates. Then, to what extent would alternative proposals or policies affect those employer rates? And so we will look at a list of candidate policies and proposals and look at how employer rates would vary under those various candidates. And those, clearly there are many more that could have been analyzed, but this provides a pretty good breadth of a variety of different proposals. And then finally, Oregon Business Council, to bring this into some context, asked us how those employer rates relate to the state general fund. So we'll spend a little bit of time at the end of the presentation talking about how employer rates relate to spending in the state's general fund. Costs of the current system, again, I suspect these are figures that you've seen many times given given your expertise and the expertise on this panel. But employer rates under baseline scenarios are expected to increase from today's rate of about 10.74% to 16.5% in July, rising to 26.2% in 2007. These rates do not include the pickup of member contributions, and they will rise to more than twice the current average rate of 10.74% over the course of the next several years, and the peak rate could approach 30% under current rate adjustment rules. This chart shows our projection of employer rates under a baseline forecast, and actually shows some historic figures as well. As you can see, starting in the late 1970s through the middle of the last decade, rates sort of bop between the middle nines and middle 11, or 11.43 in that early period. And then, as you can see, are expected to rise sharply in the current period. Will ultimately reach their peaks approaching 30% early in the next decade, 2012, et cetera, and then start to decline beginning in the period of 2017 to 2021 and thereafter. There is a blue bar on this chart that you might be able to see, which is what we would describe as a levelized rate. And a levelized rate is the employer rate that if the contributions were made at that level constantly over that period of time would provide the same funding as these increases and decreases over that same period of time, and that is 23.9%. But I point that out here because we are going to report those levelized rates for the proposed alternatives, and it provides a sort of one statistic that is easy to compare between alternatives or across alternatives. Just a little bit on the sources of the problems, and again, given your expertise and the amount of time that I understand you have heard testimony on this topic, I'm sure you have heard many of these, but we will repeat them briefly here and feel free to ask for elaboration if this is the first time you've seen one of these. But clearly the guaranteed minimum returns are one of the sources. Crediting more than a minimum guarantees underfunding if the actuary's assumed rate of returns is correct. So any crediting above 8% will guarantee underfunding if the actuary is right that you should expect 8% in the future, because every nickel that you give over 8% is going to be offset sometime in the future by a loss of something under 8% that you need need to provide some reserves for. Excess crediting also produces a cascade of funding problems. So the larger our member accounts through crediting, the more you have to guarantee in the future on that same 8% guarantee for the Tier 1 members. So it exacerbates itself down the road. There are also some items within this program that we would consider or deem internal inconsistencies. For example, 8% market returns are insufficient to fund the 8% guarantee in Tier 1, and that is because contributions that are made, for example, late in the year, for example, the very end of the year in December, are nonetheless expected to produce an 8% return or are guaranteed an 8% return. And so, in essence, additional funds are required or additional higher market returns are required in order to meet that 8% guarantee. The benefit calculations use out-of-date actuarial tables. We are aware that those have there is a phase-in now of more up-to-date actuarial tables, but a number of expensive Tier 1 members will continue to use the out-of-date tables until that is fully phased in. Thirdly, the value of the 2% COLA is not considered, and this is for retirees, when calculating the initial benefit under money match or pension plus annuity. Finally, contributing to the cost of the plan are sort of this options where members receive the greater of the full formula, the money match, or if they were active before 1981, pension plus annuity. A second category of problems we would categorize as management issues as opposed to structural issues. The PERS board has credited members with more than the assumed rate in 18 of the past 26 years and more than twice the assumed rate for the plan in 5 of those years. And so while that doesn't have anything to do specifically with the structure, that crediting did exacerbate the problem. And the board, in our view, cannot accurately estimate future liabilities with actuarial models. Not to say that anything that the actuary is doing is inappropriate or not correct. They do fine work given the rules that they are told to live in. But the actuarial model assumes a constant 8% return each year and every year and has no market volatility in it. Market volatility, because of the guarantee and other factors in the plan, adds to the plan's liability. So without forecasting some variability in the market in the future, you cannot accurately forecast the plan's liabilities. And in our view, while the actuarial model will accurately estimate the unfunded actuarial liability as of a prior date, in our view, decision makers, the PERS board, legislators, et cetera, need some additional information to understand the full likelihood of future obligations. Now we're going to turn to the policy alternatives and our estimates of them under with the employer rates. We've put them in three categories, and we have ranked them on this chart from top to bottom, from those that affect total employer rates the least to those that would affect employer rates the most. In the top category, we would describe generically plans that generate no new members into Tier 1 or Tier 2, that create a successor plan in essence, but do not in any major way affect the rules in Tier 1 and Tier 2. Those generically could be defined benefit plans for the successor plan. It could be a defined contribution plan in that successor plan, or it could be a combination of both. The second major category, and again, this is our terminology, is a current system overhaul, so a major change in the rules for Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, and then also likely some type of changes into the future. In that category, we have estimated House Bill 2003, and we have also put in an estimate for an option that would turn basically everybody going forward into full formula only. That, in essence, will give you a feel for the price of the money match by basically eliminating the money match. Then the final category is basically plan termination. stopping the PERS program as it exists today completely and, in essence, cashing out member accounts, and then moving forward with a completely revised system. So it erases, erases PERS altogether. Again, like the new members, the successor plans can look very much like the plans that have been developed under the new member category, or no new member category, defined benefit plan, defined contribution plans, or some combination of both. Now, just to clarify what it was we were estimating, again, in the same order, for the no new members, these are new plans for new hires. Current members continue with existing or a modified plan. In the numbers that you will see, the current members are going forward with the existing plan. New hires would be in a new plan, which again could be a defined benefits plan. An example of that would be Representative McPherson's plan, and there we are looking only at the defined benefit portion of your plan because we are doing our analyses from the employer's perspective only for this point, for this analysis. Or it could be a defined contribution plan, the so-called FAIR plan, or again, some combination of both. Under the category of the current system overhaul, House Bill 2003 has several major changes. First of all, it would call for the full and immediate implementation of the correct actuarial tables. It would suspend COLAs for current retirees who received excess earning credits in 1999, and it would cease member contributions, the so-called 6% solution. That has the effect of slowing the growth of member accounts, which has the effect of making full formula more attractive than money match over time. And then, in essence, all new members would retire under full formula. And then again, this major point at the bottom, converting the current plan to full formula only by eliminating the money match, is also an option that we have evaluated. Finally, under plan termination, the steps that one would take would be to fully fund the benefits in force for current retirees. Members would receive account balances. Under the costing that we have done, we have assumed that vested members would receive twice their account balances. I believe there could be other assumptions made here, but this is the assumption we are making for the purposes of our testimony today. And the successor plan would consist of defined benefits, defined contributions, or some combination of both. To compare the costs, as we mentioned before, employer rates are a measure of cost, but as you saw in that chart previously, the rates move up and down over time, which makes it hard to compare the differences in the costs of the plan over time. So we have moved to a different way of presenting the numbers, which is a levelized approach to employer rates, and that would be a rate that, if paid each year, has the same present value as the stream of actual employer rates. And again, we do that to make for ease of comparison of different policies. And this chart presents our findings. Starting at the top, for comparison purposes, are our projections for the current system. And this is consistent with the chart that you saw previously. Employer rates on a levelized, measured on a levelized fashion, would be 23.9% for the next 25 years under the current system if there are no additional changes made to that plan. And a plan that was a no new member plan but left Tier 1 and Tier 2 intact, and the successor plan had an 8% normal cost and a defined benefit. We estimate that estimated employer rates would fall slightly to 23.2%. And then no new member plans and a defined contribution plan with a 6% normal cost. Again, because the normal cost is somewhat lower there, the employer rates fall to 22.3%. Moving down the list, House Bill 2003 because it does address some of the costs with Tier 1 and Tier 2 members or existing members. It does bring the cost down somewhat obviously more than those that we have just discussed. We estimated employer rates would fall to 15.3% over the course of the next 25 years. If there was a way to turn the current system into full formula only for the existing members and future members, employer rates would fall to 13.8%. So in essence, the difference between this estimated plan and the current system is an illustration of the cost of the money match. Then finally, the two options at the bottom are plan termination with a defined benefit plan at an 8% normal cost. We estimate would have a cost of 13.1% in terms of employer rates. And then finally, plan termination with a defined contribution at a 6% normal cost would have an 11.1% estimated employer rate going forward. With respect to the color coding on this table, the darker is the shade of gray on the table, the more uncertainty there is around the estimate. And that, in essence, Carl can elaborate on that in the question and answer period, but the bottom line is the more moving parts there are in a plan, the more uncertain is the estimate. And so clearly the bottom plan that has plan termination and defined contribution is the most stable of those estimates because defined contributions are quite stable. They are defined that way and do not relate to market returns in any way. For those of you who are more graphically oriented, this slide basically presents the same information as the last slide, but in graphical form. Underlying the estimates of the plan termination are the costs that we considered in terms of costs associated with terminating the current plan. We do understand we are not lawyers, and I think there would be considerable debate about what would be required to terminate the plan, but these are the costs that we considered and that are reflected in those estimates that you just saw. Basically, two steps that would be required. First of all, you would have to fully fund the benefits in force. The actuarial value of the benefits in force at our current estimate is $17.7 billion. The BIF assets are $14.3 billion. So the net cost of fully funding the BIF today would be $3.4 billion. The next step would be to liquidate the member accounts. The value of the vested member accounts as of January 1st, 2003, $9.7 billion. We assume for the purposes of this estimate that you would match the vested member accounts dollar for dollar, which would add another $9.7 billion, and that you would also provide for the value of unvested member accounts. This is an admittedly crude estimate, but we place it at $300 million. So the amount needed to liquidate the member accounts totals $19.8 billion. Basically, what we have to do that with now are member assets at a little over $10 billion and employer assets a little over $8.7 billion. Total assets available $18.7 billion. So the net cost to liquidate the member accounts would be almost $1.1 billion. So if we take those two steps of fully funding the BIF and liquidating the member accounts, we get to a net cost of terminating the plan of $4.5 billion. Thinking back to that notion of a levelized cost on employer rates, the cost that we estimate, if that were done on a levelized basis, would be 5.1% to liquidate the plan going forward for the next 25 years. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, we wanted to put this in the context, these numbers in some context, of the state general fund, which I'm sure is another lofty issue that you folks are dealing with on a daily basis. Clearly, employer rates affect well beyond the state general fund. They affect the funds of municipalities and governments throughout the state of Oregon. But these slides relate only to the state general fund for the time being. The state obviously is a PERS employer. They directly employ general service, judiciary, public safety, and legislators, and indirectly help support the cost of PERS for K-12 education through the state school fund. In developing the governor's budget, the Department of Administrative Services, in their first pass on this budget, has assumed a 4 percentage point increase in employer rates between the last, well, between this current biennium and the next biennium. That translated to $250 million in additional general fund spending, that 4 percentage point increase. Two-thirds of that amount was attributed to the state school fund and monies that would be required to support PERS, increase PERS spending in the state school fund. Employer rates are actually expected to increase an additional 4 percentage points in this next biennium, so for a total of 8 points in total, if the PERS system is unchanged. So implicitly, the governor's budget is assuming that the legislature and the governor will find some solution to affect a 4 percentage point decrease in PERS employer rates, or the shortfall that has been estimated will be higher than has been projected to this point. As a rule of thumb, each percentage point increase in employers' rates will increase the 03-05 general fund expenditures by $63 million, assuming a constant workforce. And again, if PERS changes do not immediately reduce employer rates, the estimated general fund shortfall could increase by up to $250 million in 03-05. And then finally, if the plan remains unchanged, rising employer rates would put additional pressure on future budgets. Employer rates are expected to go up to the neighborhood of 17 without the member contributions for the 03-05 budget, but as you saw in those earlier projections, if unchanged, PERS could rise to as high as 29%, each of those percentage points with a $63 million price tag. So our general conclusions, failing to act will result in employer rates that would increase to more than twice the current rates for the next 25 years. Plan alternatives affect employer rates by varying degrees. Addressing only new hires will have very little effect on employer rates during the next 25 years. Overhauling the current system can reduce employer rates, but cannot return rates to the current level. Terminating the current system could produce rates that are close to the current level. PERS employer rates are an important driver of the state general fund expenditures, and PERS policies will certainly shape the state's fiscal position for years to come. That seems an obvious point with the analyses that we have produced. At this point, we welcome questions about the analysis. I will, if this gets into the details of the modeling, I will defer to my colleague, Carl Batten, who is far more expert on this than myself.
Questions? Representative McPherson here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tapania. I'd like to explore your credentials. Are you a fellow of the Society of Actuaries?
I am not.
And is Mr. Baden?
Mr. Batten?
Batten, I'm sorry.
I am not.
Okay. And is there either of you associates of the Society of Actuaries?
No, we are not. Okay. I've relied on work by Mark Johnson, who is a fellow.
Okay. And it is your firm, Echo Northwest. How many pension plan terminations has that your firm handled?
Yeah.
Okay. You've outlined some costs for plan termination in which you come to a bottom line that shows that we could resolve the obligations of upon termination of the system by matching the value that is in the accounts today. Is there a legal analysis that you've based that economic model on, that is the ability to cover what is in the accounts today without anything with respect to the statutory provisions that relate to what happens on into the future to ongoing member accounts?
We have not, and we have not. Our analysis for all of these options is this is what it would cost if you could do it. We have not determined that you can do any of these things.
Right. So, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I should be asking for permission to go forward if I could with each question.
I'll give you some leeway.
Okay, thank you. and you anticipate that there would be legal analysis that would come forth that, or is there an analysis that you have that we don't have that says that that's permissible to say that we would cover the account balances that are in place currently and match them, and that would be sufficient to meet our legal obligations?
We would leave that to legal experts to make that determination.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on another issue here. There was a reference to a couple of the proposals that we have pending in our committee as the defined benefit and defined contribution, and I'm curious about why did you characterize the McPherson plan as compared to the FAIR plan and describe the McPherson plan as defined benefits rather than a combination of both when in fact it has both elements?
We're looking at this from the perspective of the employer rates, and when we look at these employer rates, we are not considering the employer costs of the pickup. And the way we were thinking of your plan is that the defined benefit portion of your plan would replace the part of the current plan that is considered the employer contribution now for new hires, and that your defined contribution portion of your plan would replace the part of the current system that is called employer pickup. And none of these estimated employer rates that we show include any pickup.
Okay. If I could further, Mr. Chair,
follow up.
When you refer to the cost of a defined contribution system in elsewhere in your numbers as a 6% normal cost, are you aware that the FAIR plan proposal that's before us involves, as I understand it, based on the testimony before our committee, individual elections by members to decide to contribute up to 6% for general service or a higher rate for police and fire with then a one-for-one employer match? Were you taking into account the likelihood that many employees wouldn't choose to make that contribution to the system if, in fact, you were referring to the FAIR plan when you were looking at the cost of a defined contribution system, or were you taking into account the fact that maybe many people wouldn't contribute?
The cost we estimated was a 6% cost to employers, which is what would happen under the FAIR plan if every employee contributed 6%. The reason we put those names with these is to make them a little bit less abstract for the members of the committee so that they could relate the concepts to plans that they have already seen and heard some testimony on. We didn't attempt to exactly replicate any particular proposed replacement successor plan.
Just to clarify, the estimates that you see on this particular table are what they are. The no new members with a defined benefit at an 8% normal cost is just that. And the no new members with a defined contribution at a 6% normal cost is just that. It is not the FAIR plan specifically. It is precisely what you are looking at. And nor is the previous one your plan.
Okay. Mr. Chair? What I'm hearing you say is that what you've referenced here in terms of costs on the employer rates using a 6% or 8% kind of model does not refer to the two proposals that are before us, because the defined contribution proposal is one that involves elective employee action. Is that right?
That is correct. And to further clarify, there's no particular reason why a plan that is a defined benefit plan has to have an 8% normal cost. We chose that as a representative normal cost of a defined contribution plan. There's no reason why a defined contribution plan has to have a 6% normal cost. We chose that as a normal cost that is representative of defined contribution plans.
Mr. Chair? Mm-hmm. So it's purely coincidental that you used an 8%, which is the cost that the actuary provided for the Oregon retirement plan that I have proposed, and it used a 6% cost, which is the maximum amount that is in the FAIR plan that Representative Richardson proposed.
It's more than coincidence that we used the 8% cost that Mr. Johnson calculated for your proposal. We believe that Mr. Johnson does excellent work and that would be a good estimate, and it seems that your proposal was a good representative of a defined benefit plan. So for representing a defined benefit plan, which part of your proposal is, we chose to use that 8% that was calculated by what we consider to be a reliable source as a representative normal cost for a defined benefit plan.
Further, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Do you have any experience with modeling what the actual conduct of employees is when presented with a one-for-one match opportunity? That is, the tendency of employees when presented with the opportunity to get a one-for-one match from their employer to actually put the dollars into the plan that will gain the match?
We don't, and that the what you see up here is the no new members in DC is not an attempt to do that. It is modeling a plan that would be different from the plan that has been called the FAIR plan. This would be modeling a plan where the employer puts in 6% and the employee puts in some equal difference or no amount. But this is modeling a plan where the employer puts in exactly 6%.
Mr. Chair, if you'll yield the opportunity to make a comment, then I'll cut off the line of questioning. I want to applaud the economic analysis from this firm is very helpful. I think that Equal Northwest is a very capable firm. What I would urge you, gentlemen, is that when you shift over into the benefits analysis, there are experiences that people have who worked in that field that would have brought maybe some precision to those kinds of issues that would may have been more helpful to the committee to understand the real choices that are before us, and that to present an elective plan as being a 6% normal cost plan, I just think it's not a fair characterization of what's been presented.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond?
Sure.
It was not our intention to represent this as a cost of the proposed so-called FAIR plan. In an earlier slide, we listed the FAIR plan as an example of a defined contribution plan, but this is modeling a plan with a 6% normal cost.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. If you permit me.
Global question?
8% happens to be the cost that Mark Johnson calculated for the pension program within the hybrid proposal that I have brought forward. But 8% has no particular relationship to defined benefit cost. Many defined benefit plans cost 6%, they cost 4%, they cost 9%, they cost, in the case of many public plans elsewhere, 14 or 15%. So there's I regard the statement that you were modeling just a conventional defined benefit plan and a eventual defined contribution plan as disingenuous. I think, in fact, you are by implication trying to model the two proposals that are before our committee, and yet you haven't really costed the effect of the defined contribution component, because you have not considered the fact that it's an elective plan and it depends on employee choice, which is a critical function or aspect of how it functions.
Okay. Well, I have a question.
Representative Richardson. Representative McPherson, do you have information relating to experience as it relates to employee choice in a matched situation that you'd like to share with us?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that data myself, and I think that would be important for us to have if we pursue the choice-modeled defined contribution plan. That is to see to what extent are employees actually incented and at what stages in their working career to part with the dollars that it takes to get the one-for-one match, because the anecdotal experience, and I think there is scientific evidence to support this, is that younger employees who see retirement as a much more remote time of life tend to contribute at a much lower rate, even when they have a rather strong incentive to do so, and that employees who are closer to retirement then are induced to contribute at a high rate.
Mr. Chair,
okay.
Representative McPherson, one of the whole points of doing this is to get more. We've asked these folks to do this under pretty tight time frames, understanding that you had some important choices, and we would love to refine all of these to make them as clear as they can be. One of the key points I think we took away was to get our minds around how big a difference the successor plan makes to the total problem, and that's one of the frankly when you look at these numbers. The point is, in either case, it's a relatively small chunk of the problem, and you know that, but I thought it was important to get at that in mind, and that's one of the reasons we ran these. But if you'd like us to run in a more refined model and take your names off of these, that's fine. We can do that.
Mr. Chair?
I think Carl wanted to respond, and then we'll go to you, Representative Richardson. Thank you.
I just wanted to make one quick observation, and that's that one thing we can say without having modeled the behavior of employees who are given choices is that if they were to choose less than the maximum contribution, the cost of the defined contribution plan would be lower.
Thank you. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, first of all, it would have been, I want to make sure we don't focus on the wrong thing with this presentation.
Sure.
If your chart, which says DB 8%, DC 6, had, if you deleted the words and DB or DC, is it correct that these figures would apply whether it was a defined benefit or a defined contribution at 8% or at 6%? I mean, we're not talking about the type of plan. We're talking about the percentage of cost to an employer. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Correct. Okay, so rather than focusing on that, let's focus on the numbers that you've come up with, because that's what's most significant with the work that you've done. You'd said something that I'm interested in. You said that an 8% return on investment is insufficient to pay the 8% guarantee. And my understanding was because over the course of a year, money is being contributed. And say there's no raise during that year, so it'll be roughly 1/12. There's money going in every month.
Right.
And so the money that's going in December is part of the pool increase for that entire year that's getting 8% as if it had been in there for the entire 12 months. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. With that in mind, do you have an idea of how much or what kind of percentage return would be required to pay for a guarantee of 8% when you've got a 1/12 increase ramping up over the course of a year?
I have not calculated that. My guess is that it would be somewhere between 8 and 8.5% would be required. It would depend on the ratio of new contributions to existing balances in the Tier 1 accounts. And because Tier 1 accounts are all held by people who have been employed for a number of years, almost all of them have significant balances.
Can you
follow up?
Also, you indicated that this levelized figure was 23.9% for 25 years. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, now, since we've got 857 employers that are in the PERS system, and 65% of them or more pay the 6% pickup, can we just put that on top? For those that are paying the pickup, would that levelized number be 29.9%?
Assuming they continue to pay the pickup for the next 25 years, yes.
Okay. And just to look back at your numbers, you're saying that there is a need to take drastic action because of the unfunded liability, and that if there was a termination, if it could legally be done, and I understand that that's, you're not giving legal opinion, you're just saying that based on the numbers, this is what you're showing, that if there was a termination of Tier 1, Tier 2, and it, and all employees were to go into a new plan that was either costing 8% or 6%, the numbers you gave, that the 25-year liability would go for those that are paying the pickup from 29.9% to either 13.1% or 11.1%. Is that correct?
The 13.1 and 11.1 do not include the pickup. So for those who are currently paying the pickup, if they were to continue to pay the pickup, you would add 6 to those to get a comparison with the 29. If they were to stop paying the pickup,
right,
as you described, it would be 2.
Okay. And then this is, I'm not an economist, and I'm sure I could ask Mary, but I'll ask you since you're there. May I follow up? I know the idea that if you flip a coin, every time you flip it, it's 50%. But you're, in your records, you say that of the last, or of 26 years, 18 of them had amounts that exceeded 8% and were credited to the employee's accounts. Is that correct?
Basically, we said that in 18 of the past 26 years that there was crediting in excess of 8%.
Yes. Okay, so what it gets to is this 8% is supposed to be an average figure, average rate of return over 40 years. And if it has been over 8% in 18 of 26 years, is it reasonable to assume that if that 8% was correct, that in the next 12 years or 20 years, that it's more likely than not that it's, that the returns will be less than 8% to counterbalance the fact that it's been over 8, in 18 years, it's been over 8.
Well, this statistic is actually not precisely the way that you've described it. I mean, there, in those years, there were returns in excess of 8%.
Of the assumed rate.
Of the assumed rate,
the assumed
right.
rate was initially set at 5.5%. It was then increased to 7%, then
that's
increased
true.
To 7.5%.
That's true. Since 89.
Then increased to 8%. Some of the years in which they credited more than the assumed rate, they credited less than, they just credited less than 8% because the assumed rate wasn't always 8%.
Okay. Final question. Am I correct that you said that if nothing is done, the governor's is going to need to go back into his budget and allow for an extra $250 million that will be expended toward the unfunded liability the next biennium?
It is my understanding in conversations with the Department of Administrative Services that for the purposes of making their 03-05 budget, they assumed a 4 percentage point increase and assumed, when the actuary was in essence telling them it was going to be an 8 percentage point increase, and they are assuming policy will affect some or all of that difference of that. So if there is no action taken and in reality the rates go up by 8 percentage points, then you would have roughly an additional $250 million holding all other factors constant added to whatever you're considering your shortfall, your budget shortfall is.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, if we don't do our job, we may want to send a memo to Ways and Means about an extra $250 million. And a final comment for Mr. McPherson and those, as far as this, the earlier discussion is concerned, the FAIR Plan presently has a draft, a request for amendments, which will provide a partial base to employees, regardless of whether they pay anything into the plan, to help provide for the younger employees that who may not have the vision to contribute on their own, which obviously was not considered in these figures. And so that's why one of the reasons I want to bring it up, so that we don't focus on any ulterior motives. We have an 8% and a 6% here, but the plan, as it actually ends up, is something that is not, it's still a work in process on both sides.
Thank you. Representative Nolan, did you have your hand up earlier?
No.
Nope. Anyone else? Representative Barker, did you? No? Just want to make sure I covered everybody.
I want you to leave the Ways and Means people alone, Mr. Chair, whatever you do.
You can take the message back, right?
If only if we're saving you money should be calling you. Is that correct?
They believe in killing the messenger over on that site, so be careful.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you for your presentation. We appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2008 or House Bill 2020?
Rick.
Or House Bill 2003?
On yours. I don't mean to refer to it.
Nobody signed up?
Well, they
kind
of tick me off.
Okay. All right. What's that?
That's a no from Marla.
Okay. We are another amendment being drafted in House Bill 2003 because I'm having some drafted again. I think I've mentioned this before. If you have ideas that you want drafted into House Bill 2003, definitely bring those forward because I'm sure the people who are bringing 2003 forward would like to also have a look at those to know how their bill might be used in the future. And Representative Richardson, you said you have amendments that are coming.
Okay.
Hopefully available tomorrow.
Tomorrow would be fine. If LC cooperates.
They've been very
busy.
They've been very good, and I hope that they'll be able to get those done.
They have been very cooperative.
Representative Corey, to give a speech to give? Or?
No, thank you, though, for asking.
You're welcome.
I just want to make sure we've covered all the bases. You've been very tolerant today, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate it.
I hate to end early, you know. So
just I would like to register a complaint,
sure.
Since I scheduled to be here till 5:30, I've never done it before.
There will be no charge for that hour and a half back of your life. So, thank you very much, committee. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearings on House Bill 2003, 2008, House Bill 2020. And I think if there's nothing else for the committee, we will adjourn till Tuesday. So look forward to seeing you. Yes, Representative Nolan.
The public hearings.
We did all of our taps probably before you came in.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So those bills, those vehicles have been preserved for at least next week. And beyond that, the speaker's discretion. Committee adjourned.